business. The kingdom was lost because the message wasn't delivered. The message wasn't delivered because the horse was lame. The horse became lame because it lacked a shoe. It lacked a shoe for want of a nail. Carelessness.
I didn't know it was slaughtered.
Stand by for adventure. Once again, the four friends are assembled in the wood-paneled study of Dr. Juan Adillo, noted scientist and philosopher. You remember the rest of the group, of course. There by the fireplace, his long fingers fondling his pipe, is Major Gordon. And the short man sniffing one of Dr. Avillo's excellent cheroots is Captain Quigley, merchant skipper. The fourth man is Richard Moore, journalist adventurer. At the moment, he seems perturbed.
Dr. Avillo, your rig.
My rig? I don't understand.
Well, as I came into the house, I noticed it lying carelessly in the hall.
Not a good place for a rake, Moore, if that's what you're getting at.
Exactly, Captain Quigley. It's very dangerous. Someone might step on it and get hurt.
I think you're quite right, Mr. Moore. It was careless on my part to leave it there.
In the army, Doctor, we found the penalty for carelessness is very often death.
Yes, and very often, Major, the same result occurs in more peaceful pursuits.
Ah, do I smell a story brewing, Moore?
Who was it who said that a man with imagination could find a saga in a crust of bread?
I have a saga, gentlemen, about a careless man. His name was Philip Lind. I met him in 1932. My syndicate sent me to Geneva to report on the doings of the League of Nations. Well, Geneva was so crowded that I had to share an apartment in the hotel with a compatriot and a colleague, Philip Lind, a correspondent for a large New York daily whom I had never met before. But I assure you I was totally unprepared for what I found in the apartment. When I entered, I just stood and stared. The place was strewn with miscellaneous items of clothing, neckties, shirts. The carpet was totally obscured by cigarette butts. All in all, a shambles. But it prepared me for the shock of actually meeting my new roommate. He came in as I stood there staring. Aside from the fact that he wore a pair of mismated socks, a necktie that demonstrated his menu for the past 2 weeks.
Good Lord.
And a battered Panama hat. This in late November, mind. Philip Lind was not too carelessly dressed. But as I came to know him in the weeks and months that followed, I got to like him quite a lot. He was generous, good-natured, a real friend. The only fly in the ointment was that Philip Lind had, when aroused, a horrible temper. And he was always completely, supremely sloppy, careless. It was amazing to me when he introduced me to Marion Groves, the lady of his choice, because she was in all as different as could be from him. She was petite, true English blonde, and immaculately neat and tidy. Isn't it strange how opposites sometimes attract? Marion loved Philip, loved him to the exclusion of everything and everyone else. Philip loved her too, after fashion, carelessly. Oh, I suppose he loved her as much and as well as he could love anyone. That was why August the 5th surprised us so. I'll never forget that night. The three of us were at a small restaurant having dinner. We all enjoyed the meal, Marion, Philip and I, and Philip's necktie. It was over coffee that it happened. Without a hint of warning, Philip proposed. Yes, Philip. And with a nod that surprised me and left Marion practically speechless. Practically, but not quite. She very clearly said, yes. I ordered champagne to toast the betrothal. Philip sprang to his feet and announced that Marion and he would be married immediately. Well, with some difficulty we convinced him that 11 o'clock at night was a slightly unusual hour for the nuptials. Accordingly, grudgingly, with a sense of being truly magnanimous, Philip consented to a proper engagement before getting married. 12 hours. So it was agreed to meet the following morning at 11 at the English Chapel. The next morning, Philip graciously bestowed upon me the privilege of getting him dressed properly. I also went out to buy the wedding ring, since I had been promoted to best man, agreeing to meet Philip at the church with him. But somehow I just couldn't get the excited feeling that a wedding is supposed to produce. Instead, I had the feeling that this wedding was destined for trouble, or worse. At 11 sharp, I was at the church with the ring. Most weddings fit a pattern, eager-eyed bride in white, shining face tilted confidently, happily, with the assured feeling that the world and all its tomorrows, gay, ecstatic tomorrows, are hers and his. The groom, nervous, slightly ill at ease, just about two steps this side of the jitters, desperately eyeing the door and the freedom beyond as the organ peals forth its music by Mendelssohn. And ultimately, the sonorous voice of the minister and the time-honored formula of the marriage ceremony. Well, Marion filled the bill. Dressed in her long white gown and filmy veil, carrying the bridal bouquet of white flowers, eyes dancing with an infinite joy. The music, the minister, all fit the pattern. The one discoherent note was Philip. He never showed up. At 1:15, Marion, crying with disappointment, shame, and I suspected fury, ran out of the church. I made some mumbled excuses to the startled minister, left, grabbed a cab, and went to the apartment. Shortly after, Philip entered the apartment, his face contorted with rage. He berated me, accused me of having turned Marion against him. I managed to stem the torrent of hot, angry words, asked him to explain his behavior, his absence. I told him how hurt Marion was, how cruelly he had treated her, that it had been a mortal insult to have left her waiting at the altar of the English chapel. He stared. His eyes changed. Rage left, bewilderment entered. I waited at the chapel in the suburbs, he said. And there it was. Philip had gone to the wrong church. As always, careless. Well, I understood, knowing Philip. Marion didn't and didn't want to. He tried to see her, to call on the phone to explain. Time and again he tried. Marion refused to see or to talk with him. He began to brood about it. But Geneva was alive with news. The league was up to big things. And Philip, good reporter that he was, found his days busy and full. Fascism was rising like a malignant star whose light was death, using hate, murder, lies. And they were already beginning to rock the foundation of world peace. Philip began to sense what was going on, long before anyone else did. His dispatches were the talk of the whole world, though the appeasers wrote vicious criticisms, often branding him a sensationalist and a liar. But through it all, Philip went his own way, writing the news as he saw it, and missing Marion. One fine morning in June, the delegates of the fascist nations got up before the League Council and announced their country's resignations. There was a stampede from the press section for the cable office. The flash went out to the world. The front pages of every newspaper carried it in screaming headlines. Philip Lind was vindicated. He had correctly foretold this first step towards war. Philip Lind was a hero. But the next morning, Philip Lind was fired. Yes, that's right, fired. You see, waiting his turn at the cable office to file the story to his paper, he had gone into a restaurant for a bite to eat. He lingered and lingered, and finally forgot to file his dispatch. Again, in his moment of triumph, Philip Lind had been cursed. Well, his paper sent Jack Knight to replace him. One afternoon in November, I returned to the apartment alley and found Philip sitting at his desk. Carefully, ever so carefully, cleaning a revolver, putting little swabs of cotton on the ramrod and cleaning the chambers and the barrel. He was muttering oaths, steadily, but quietly, yet with more hate in his voice than I ever want to hear again. I'm going to shoot his head off, he said. Who? Jack Knight. He stole Marion from me. First my job, now Marion. What do you mean he stole Marion from me? Slowly, quietly, he answered. They're engaged, but he'll never marry her. I'm going to kill him. He said it just as one might say, a loaf of bread, please. Well, I tried to talk him out of it, to consider, but he was determined, couldn't be swayed. I ran out of the apartment and called Jack Knight, warned him to get out of Geneva as fast as he could. He laughed at me. Well, what more could I do? I hung up, went back to the apartment. Philip was gone. And so was his gun. Desperately, I sprinted to the street, hailed a cab. I was in agony. I knew Philip was determined to kill Jack Knight, that he had been calm, careful. This time, he'd been thorough. The cab stopped at Jack Knight's place. I paid the driver, ran up the stairs two at a time. Just as I reached the landing, I heard the shot. I was too late. The body lay on the carpet. The red blood oozing out of the black hole in his forehead, dripping down and mingling with the dust on the floor. I kneeled. My heart was very heavy within me, and stared into Philip Lynn's dead, vacant eyes. Yes, I said Philip Lynn's dead eyes. He had forgotten to remove one of the cleaning swabs from the barrel of the gun. The bullet he had shot at Jack Knight had been blocked. The gun barrel exploded into hundreds of pieces. Carelessness again. Carelessness. And the death of Philip Lind. And that, my friends, is the end of my story.
Well, Mr. Moore, I now appreciate your mentioning my carelessness with my rake.
Well, where are you going in such a hurry, Major?
Well, I can't for the life of me recall whether I took the swab out of my pistol when I cleaned it the other day. I'm going home and check on it right now.